You had a tour this morning that will suffice for much of what we need to do today related to construction. So I have an amended, shorter version of a report, just a few projects to update you on. But before I do, could you queue up the sustainability slides? Before I do, I'd like to follow up on something we discussed at our July Board of Regents meeting that we didn't have time. We deferred it to another meeting. And so I'd like to take this opportunity this time to introduce to you Christian Ryan Downing, our coordinator of campus sustainability. And she will just take a few moments to update you on sustainability in higher education and how that applies to what we're doing as well. And just give you a quick overview of where we are in that regard.
I'm going to set my timer because I know I have 10 minutes. I know that Mr. Osborne is timing me as well. So a big part of my job is the opportunity to tell our story of sustainability here at WKU. And so obviously I'm thrilled for the opportunity to share the latest chapter of our sustainability story with you all. But right now my mind's actually on a bigger story of sustainability in higher education, because I just returned from the ASHE conference. ASHE is the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education. And ASHE was founded just 4 years ago in 2006 and now has hundreds of institutional, organizational, and business members. The conference was in Denver this past week on 10-10-10. And it was a sold-out conference. Over 2,000 people attended this conference, and it was university administrators, faculty, staff, and students. To me, the biggest story from this conference was the student summit. And so on Sunday, before the conference proceedings actually began, they conducted the student summit. Over 500 students from all over the country convened in Denver for this student summit. And they had workshops and different sessions, and some of the topics of the sessions were, and these are student sessions, eliminating bottled water on campus, sustainable Greek chapters, moving beyond coal, student green fees, rural economics and climate change, and making your campus food real. And I'm here to tell you that food is the topic right now on our campus when it comes to sustainability and our students. 2 years ago, their main concern was recycling, that we didn't have enough recycling opportunities. And so we worked with them, and now we have recycling bins all over campus, and they are very well used, and our students are very satisfied with the recycling opportunities. A year ago, they were very concerned about the fact that we combust coal in our central steam plant for heat. And so, and actually they got the Sierra Club involved. Our students are very engaged. And so we had lots of discussions and worked with them, and we used our energy savings to invest in a natural gas boiler for our steam plant. And actually, natural gas boiler number 2 will be coming online hopefully this winter. Our students are thrilled. They feel like they have a voice and they've been listened to. They actually wanted to hang banners on campus thanking you for the natural gas boiler. So our students feel like they have a voice. And their voice right now, I'll just warn you because you'll be hearing more about this, is about real food. So our story...
Meaning?
Meaning... When they talk about real food, they're talking about food that's grown locally. They want to eat food that's grown by producers that are here in our region. They want to know the farmers that grew their food.
How does that help sustainability?
So a big part of our carbon footprint is the movement of food from place to place. And so the average farm to fork distance for your meal is about 1,500 miles. Our students are acutely aware of the carbon footprint of producing food. So producing locally is sustainable in that way, and that's just one detail. Just knowing your farmer and supporting your local community. I must tell Mr. Osborne that universities that have started sourcing local where they can are actually seeing documented benefits in their local economies. And so, you know, students are aware of these things as well. Our students do the research. They know the issues and want to be engaged in the solutions. So food's the hot topic right now, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure. But conferences like ASHE and I have lots of opportunities to share our stories, both formally through presentations at different conferences and also in just talking with colleagues at other institutions. It gives us an opportunity to tell our story. And our story shapes up very well. People are invariably impressed by what we're doing here at WKU. And I think, can you advance for me? So the feedback that I get from the folks that I talk with about the things that we're doing here on our campus, they like these things that are listed up here. The fact that we've included sustainability in our strategic plan, our resolution on education for sustainability. Institutions are using our energy policy as a model, our commitment to LEED buildings, modeling our best practices. But even though it's at the bottom, the student engagement is really at the heart of our story. Our students are engaged, they know the issues, they want to be part of the solution. And so I want to just show you a couple of ways that students have been engaged lately that I think are really interesting. Frank, can you show us the Reduce Your Use website? So because our students are incredibly aware of how we use energy on campus, Energy Management and HRL, Housing and Residence Lab, teamed up to do something really cool for our students. And that was to produce an energy dashboard for our residence halls. And so for the month of October, our resident students are competing to see which resident hall can most reduce their use. And if you can just scroll down and then click, oh, there we go. So just keep going. So if you go to the website, you can see pictures of some of the bulletin boards that they've put together in the residence halls, and they're really very creative. But if you click on the green banner, and we'll just check in and see which resident hall is ahead in the Reduce Your Use competition. No? So the prizes here for the hall that most reduces their use is an ice cream party. And I've just ordered tubs and tubs, I won't say how many, of Big Red Rumble. And President Ransdell has agreed to come and present the trophy. And so they're working really, really hard. Okay, so just scroll down and click here on competition.
Which comes from Cal's and was made at Cheney's Dairy, which is just out the
National Road.
Okay, so it looks like Gilbert Hall is currently in first place. But look at these numbers. Gilbert Hall, and same with Meredith and even Zacharias, they have reduced their energy use by 28% over this time last month. That's remarkable. I mean, they're out there doing things. They're turning off lights, and they're unplugging, and they're serious about this competition. Just scroll down, and we'll see how the other halls are doing. Those halls have a little bit of work to do, but now if this doesn't mean anything to you, you can select a unit equivalent. And let's see how that measures up in hamburgers. They figured out how much energy is embodied in a hamburger. So we have saved 132,000 hamburgers for the use so far this month.
I'm sure the cows appreciate it.
Need more chicken.
So anybody can log on to this.
Go back to that select a use unit equivalent. I'll have to.
Dollars?
Coal. Cool.
Very cool.
All right, now do dollars. Okay. Carbon footprint.
Ooh.
Pretty cool.
Pretty cool. Yeah, we love it. And I actually have to say that Brian Kuster was the one that when he saw this, he said, we have to have this for our students. And so we're really grateful to him for providing this. And we're working on actually getting the entire campus on the dashboard. So when we do things like the conservation vacation over winter break, we can log on and see how we're doing as a campus in conserving energy. So pretty exciting.
So will you be able to break it down by a campus building?
Eventually. Eventually. And it just takes time. Of course, every building needs a meter, and all the meters have to be intertied to our energy management system. And so it's a little bit of a process, but we're getting there. I think it'd be really fun to have.
Our ESPC project, when it's completed, will get us there.
Is that right?
We're still about 12 months away from getting it all done.
Energy savings performance contract that we're now in.
So the students are really buying into what you're doing here, and it's creating looks to me like a good esprit de corps among the students.
Oh, absolutely, and I'll just give you a...
They need to see faculty and staff buying in too.
Yeah, they do, and they're not shy about holding us accountable when they see us wasting energy or not being wise with our resources. Our students are the first to call us to... to answer for that. Right. Isn't that
quickly, right? Just a point of information. Christian's right. We have an amazing story, and our student involvement is unprecedented. We got a call in the SGA office, not the sustainability office, a couple weeks ago from somebody from Jackson State University in Mississippi, wanting to start a recycling program at their university and saying that they'd heard about how extraordinary ours was and was asking us how to get one started. So, of course, I emailed Kristen Lanham and Christian. And last week we had our 99th annual started by H.H. Cherry campus cleanup, and we had about 45 people out there versus probably 8 last year. So,
right.
So, Frank, can you just take us back to the last slide? And it really is my last slide because I know that I'm running. Okay, so let me just finish up. I want to show you one more thing that this is another student initiative. Our students realize that a lot of the sustainability initiatives that we want to enact on campus don't always save money. Sometimes they take a little bit of money to get started. And so our students actually have been thinking about how to promote the WKU Green Fund. And many of you may not even know that the Green Fund exists. But it is a fund that we set up through the foundation that if people want to support our sustainability efforts, this is a place that they can make donations. And so I'm going to pass around these cards. And there's duplicates in there, so if you come across a duplicate, you can pass it on. This is a project that students came up with to promote the Green Fund, and what it is it's green gifts for the holidays. And so if you want to give a gift to somebody that you know already has everything but would be interested in supporting WKU sustainability efforts, you can make a donation to the Green Fund. And the person that you're buying the gift for, or in whose name you're making the donation, gets one of these very cool cards that describes a little bit about what their donation might be used for. And so don't take the information on the back word for word. We still have some editing to do. These are proofs. But again, I mean, these cards were just, the concept was thought of by students. The design was thought of by students. And so... I can't emphasize enough how much our students want to see this happen on our campus and have really gotten engaged. So I'll stop there. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And you can look forward to the 2010 sustainability report. It will be coming out in the next month or two. And that, too, is a student-designed publication. So
describe the green tour for us a little bit.
Sure. One of the things that we have recognized is that we're a model institution for a lot of our peers in the region and even nationally for our green initiatives. And so we wanted some way to sort of formalize a tour or a way to showcase these things. And so we're working right now on what will be both a tangible and also a virtual tour. And so we'll have signage around campus that kind of looks like these signs, interpretive signs, that explain some of our green initiatives. And so, for one example, in front of the Preston Center, we'll have a sign that explains that the pool is being heated by solar. In front of the Central Steam Plant, we'll have a sign that explains that we've converted to natural gas to reduce our carbon footprint. And so it'll be a way for prospective students and parents that are visiting campus to just really visibly see our commitment and what we're doing. And then also we'll have an online tour, too, for
love the recycling bins. For those who don't work on campus, there's one on every floor of my building. It's near the stairwell. I mean, it's so easy to use. So there's just no excuse not to use it. So love those. One of the things that both students and faculty have talked with me about repeatedly is why we continue to use the 20-ounce plastic soda bottles in all of our machines, which are about the least green things you can use, instead of using the aluminum cans. What's the plan for getting us out of those 20-ounce bottles into the 12-ounce cans?
So a couple of years ago, we learned from Pepsi that they were taking out the very last aluminum can dispensing machines and replacing them all with plastic. And that was a very dark day in my life because plastic is worth zero as a recyclable and has very limited recyclability.
And that's what those bins are full of, as you well know.
Right. The majority of our waste and recycling is plastic. Aluminum, however, is worth money, and so when we recycle aluminum, actually we have money to reinvest in our recycling program. However, Pepsi maintains that the plastic bottles are what the customer wants, that when given a choice, they will choose the plastic bottles over aluminum, and so that's where we stand with the vending machines.
I think it comes down to the screw top cap.
I think they can consume
some. Put the top on, come back to it later. That's a consumer-driven commodity.
Won't they drink whatever we put in the machines?
No.
No?
No, they won't. I think Pepsi has the data that your sales will... And that's why they put those in, was because they wanted to boost the sales, and it boosted the sales significantly.
Yeah, it did, and that's really hard to argue against. I think... One area in which we can make progress is bottled water, and certainly many campuses, Washington University in St. Louis has eliminated the use of bottled water on their campus, and that's something that our students are actually talking a lot about and are interested in. So that may be one way, just encouraging reusable waters. There's things called hydration stations that are actually specifically for filling up your water bottle, your reusable water bottle, and so many campuses are going to that model. So that may be a way to reduce that plastic bottle waste. That's
real mixed message.
It's a real mixed message.
In the hydration station next to the brand new Pepsi machine in Cherry Hall, better known as the water fountain, has been turned off the second that the Pepsi machine went in. They turned the water fountain off. So, I mean, again, there is a real mixed message, and anything we can do to help get off the mixed message would be to do it.
It must be malfunctioning. We've not turned any water fountains off.
That was coincidental.
Yeah.
Okay. The way that was intentional.
Okay. Did happen the same day, though.
Is it still not working?
No, it's not. It hasn't been working all semester.
Okay.
Hasn't been working all semester.
I'll make sure we put it in work order.
It's right next to the big Pepsi machine.
Thank you guys so much.
You did a really good
job. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you.
I want to brag on Christian a little bit. Christian and Dale Dyer and Charlie Jones and John and I went to a capital planning advisory committee, a legislative hearing a couple months ago, and were invited to come in and present to that committee as the example for higher education in Kentucky on just these matters on sustainability and from building construction to the things that Christian mentioned. So our reputation is growing in this regard, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Christian does a great job in terms of the coordinators. That's just what she does. She coordinates the activities on campus with faculty, staff, students, student organizations, etc., and does a tremendous job. Thank you, Christian. If I can, I would direct your attention now to the construction report that's on pages 22 through 25 in your agenda. That's the traditional printed report that we provide you at each meeting. However, as I mentioned earlier, because of the tours this morning, I'm only going to, at this time, go over four projects with you. Of course, answer any questions you have about any project. But the four I wanted to talk about today include, of course, the music building, which broke ground just recently. There is an elevation of what that building will look like when you are standing, next to Grace Hall, looking up the hill. This is an elevation of what the building would look like when you're standing next to the Fine Arts Center, looking towards Grace Hall. So that's where we're going. Right now, all I can show you is elevations that was created. In this particular case, by our architects, who are Ross Tarrant, and the lead architect for this project is none other than Jeff Stivers, the architect who guided us on our tour this morning for the College of Education. So they also had that project.
This building will be used for large musical groups. David Lee is no longer here, but we have no place in the Fine Arts Center for our orchestra and marching band to perform all together at one time. And this will give a practice rehearsal space for our large musical groups and choirs, ensembles. So it's an interesting thing here. Some of you may remember the old music building in this. If you were here in the 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s?
Spider Hall. Spider Hall.
Okay.
With a Y, right? Yeah.
But the old music building was just
stone,
about on
stone
the...
building.
This is a stone building, just about on the same footprint. So it's...
It's a high close as there. I know what she's looking at. This is Fine Arts Center, and the footprint of the building is right here. And as you might imagine, knowing the campus as you do, this is an incredibly difficult site for a building. But it was selected after a great deal of analysis that of all the opportunities to get it near and adjacent to the building and function programmatically, that's where it needed to go. The building will be almost 26,000 square feet. It's being paid for through mostly agency bonds, but some E&G restricted funds. Of course, we just started construction just last month, and we hope to complete the construction in time for the spring semester of 12. That's not that far away. It's just a year from this coming January, so we hope to get it there. And the reason... There's a shot just taken just recently where we were just getting started breaking ground. And here's one taken. When did you take that, Ryan?
Last week.
Okay. So you can see we are, as the metaphor goes, we are truly moving dirt. It is a challenging site from which to put a building. So you can see the site preparation to get this thing ready is going to be significant.
A lot of blast in there, the rock, a lot.
We're going to have to do some.
Yeah.
But before we do, we were going to do all kinds of analysis and testing through engineering firms to survey the areas. And it's, Brian can describe it better than I. But
we're not going to call it blasting. We're going to call it seismic demolition.
There you go. Yeah. Listen,
so
true.
We've already done an 11-building pre-blast survey and going to use very low, slow charges when this is done, and there'll be a lot of notification. We have done some blasting on our campus in the last few years. Most people don't even know that we're doing it, but we are really, really, really working with Ross Tarrant Architects with the plan and how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it. We will be doing a couple per day for several consecutive days in a row. And the reason we're doing this is because of the cost effectiveness, because that whole site is solid rock.
Yeah.
And if you use the ram hole, the time and the expense is far going to exceed what we could do with small charges.
Mm-hmm. And the noise.
And the noise.
Yeah. Yeah, just got to noise a little bit with the what you're talking about doing.
You may have noticed, moving on, that we had, driving up, coming back on campus or from the Nicely Center, etc., that we have an extensive project that the primary electrical, underground electrical system that's being updated all along State and Normal. We're coming down the hill from the planetarium towards the Craven Graduate Center, and then we're going on to Normal, where it shifts. Here is an example of some of the work that demonstrates the underground work, replacing all of the underground lines, putting in duct banks. And this is a shot taken, I believe, Brian, from the top of the Industrial Education Building, looking down into what they're having to do to put these new banks and these new lines in for our underground electrical infrastructure, which we have talked about many times as being one of our greatest deferred maintenance, deferred capital renewal is the better term, conditions that we face, and that our system needs to be updated. This project, we're going to be spending almost $3 million. Skaggs and Fisher is the engineering firm that's working with us. They're helping us update our future master plan for our system as well as design this project. The buildings that will be serviced by this new service and the loop that will be created with it includes environmental science and technology, industrial ed building, Helm Library, Cravens Library. And so we are making some significant progress in these phases. Like Spaghetti Junction there. Here's what it looks like as they're putting it in. And then once they get that section completed, I got a shot to let you see that when we restore the same site, that's what happens when we're done. So in other words, we're coming back with wide walks. We've been to the city. We've gotten their permission to take some of the few spaces that's just in the bend of the road out as a permanent parking removal. And we're going to have better pedestrian safety and wider walks. So we're restoring the site in a better condition than what it was as we do it.
John, up there close to the top of the hill there, it looks like the road is going to be narrower.
Yes, sir.
And I can see that the sidewalks are wider, and that's the cause of that. But what's that going to do to traffic? Anything?
It actually is going to improve the safety for our pedestrians that are going up and down the hill. John's mentioned on the right side, we have a very good walkway down. This adds the walkway all the way down through the left. But traffic studies have shown that if we narrow a very wide street, it makes cars, people that are driving, slow down. Which will help us with our safety. But what I've noticed just in the short time that we've completed a large section down the hill is now we don't have as many students crossing
in this very area.
Yeah, to get to a wider walk.
Right, okay. Well, they ran out of sidewalk.
Yeah, right.
They literally ran out of sidewalk.
Yeah, they did on that right side.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, when this gets completed all the way down,
they'll
have this on both sides. There won't be as near a desire to make this the...
Right there at that curve.
Yeah. No, it'll still be an issue. We all know that. But not as bad as it's been. And this is a traffic calming, intentional design. Engineers tell me, you narrow this down, traffic will slow down.
Slow them down. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Osborne, question. Down there at the bottom of the hill where it turns by the library and state splits off into those houses, there's a lot of equipment being stored on that little grass island right there, correct?
Peak.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Was there a tree removed there?
There was.
Recently, was that just for storage purposes, or?
Well, I think the tree that was removed is because they're going to actually reroute State Street into a better configuration. Right now, we got a unusual Y.
Right.
And they're going to really make what I call the end of State Street come around and tee into it.
Okay.
So that's an intentional redesign of that little intersection, again, for both pedestrian and vehicular safety at that little junction.
Excellent. Thank you.
There is a shot of a theater, true picture we went back and found. Don't know the year, but it doesn't matter. This is the 1960s.
Could have been any year going back to 1970.
1970 is October, coincidentally, October of 70, 40 years ago this month, the UC opened. And the seating that was put in October of 1970 is right there in that picture. And until just a few days ago, literally, it was still there. So here is what it now is. Now, the reason you can see this seating is that we've done a little more than just the seating, but the seating is really the part that's going to make this a functional space. And we're no longer going to try. It's going to be hard for me to not call it the theater, but it's not a theater, and we're not going to use it as a theater. There's not even the capacity for a theater in there anymore. So it's going to be the DUC auditorium, of course. And the lighting and the electrical and the sprinklers and all the things that we needed to do in that space that when the time comes, the building gets renovated, we don't have to go back into this particular space. So this was, you know, snapshot, go into a specific part of a building, do what you can do to make this a functional space, because it was quite embarrassing to even have people go in there. Now, the part that bothered me the most, I'm just going to confess, is every time I saw an OAR, excuse me, ATP going there with prospective new parents and students, and they were trying to sit in those chairs. They'd end up in the floor. No. You know, I mean, it was pretty embarrassing. So we had to do this. And so now it is got, how many seats do we end up with now? 600?
660 seats.
That is a very nice functional auditorium. The slope's been properly done to current standards. And the seating is, as you can see, very attractive and very functional. Up above here is once was where the little ports were for the movies. We spent just $1.2 million on that. It was, however, very well spent in terms of what it's going to do for us. Guest boiler number two. There's a shot of a boiler that was in place in our steam plant that has been subsequently taken out, but I wanted you to see one of these before pictures. Those are actually two gas boilers in our central steam plant that had been sitting there dysfunctional, not usable, since 1979. I don't know when they went in, but they exceeded their useful life and they were just sitting there and they weren't usable. We went into a project, as you recall, last year to replace the one on the right and put in a new boiler, which, as Christian was mentioning, this is part of the removal process.
Those were coal-fired.
These were gas. These are gas, old gas that didn't work. They were inefficient when they were originally installed, but they were dysfunctional. They weren't usable. They were boat anchors. Okay? And they've been sitting there since 79, unusable. We took them out. We replaced the first one with a new boiler that you recall we did last year as a project. Go ahead and advance it for me. And there's a shot that was taken last year when we put it in. Now, what Christine was talking about earlier is that now we've got two coal burners and two gas burners in the plant. The two gas burners give us the capacity to probably operate 90% of the winter, maybe 85% of the winter, on natural gas and not use any coal whatsoever, except for what I would call a month. This coming winter. 1 month between, well, the big demand for winter will be when the students return for the spring semester and we crank up all the residence halls and all the buildings and the temperatures in mid-late January, we all know what they are. That's when the demand will reach the point to where I'm going to have to supplement the use of the two gas boilers that we have with coal. But I will only need to burn that coal until probably a month later in February, when we can then, weather-wise, demands change and we get to back to where we can continue to use natural gas. The other good news is the gas for that period of time has done been bought, then got a contract on it, and it's at a very good rate. So we already know our fuel source for the winter, and we've got it locked in terms of rate, and it will cost us less than if we had used coal as the primary source in the past. The project I wanted to tell you about today is the fact that we're getting ready and we're planning for a new boiler to go in to the left of that one. Just similar to this one, on the left of that one, will be another one installed next spring. When that's installed, we will then have three gas boilers that will, the combined capacity of those three, handle all of today's future and future prospective needs of this campus in terms of energy demand for steam, produce heat for the campus. So it's now into the future. We're capacity-wise building that into the design. And then we could be 100% at that point natural gas. So we'll only have natural gas, or excuse me, coal usage this year for about a month. Some other interesting statistics. the coal bowlers that we had installed, on that we have years ago, we've been using. One was originally installed in 1956, and the other in 1960. So I think we were ready for some upgrades anyway. I'm saying to you, they are quite the antique in there. So there was no choice for us, really. We had to do an update to the steam plant. I think that concludes my slides about the four projects I wanted to cover with you today, but happy to address any question you might have about the printed report or any project.
You might just give us a real brief update on Block 12.
Sure. Well, SPE2 organization, of which I'm a member, is moving forward with, and as you may have seen in the local papers, I can only really tell you what's also been reported in the media, in the papers, and that is that the process to start the construction on the garage has progressed enough to where they are now awarding contracts and the funding to pay for the construction of the garage as the very first step of the project is in place. And I think they're going to start actually turning dirt next week. The parking lot that's adjacent to 14th Street is being closed, and it will be incorporated per discussions at other meetings into this project. I'm only talking about the part that was going to be the former Greek Village. So next week, as early as then, you'll start seeing activity on that site, and it will be for the parking garage.
Very good. Quick follow-up. Have we got 100% commitment from our hotel developer yet?
Not yet. We're working on he's working on financing, and in fact, is bringing his team in. We're trying to get that meeting scheduled now to try to get closer to that. Actually, Deborah, is Debbie here, is working on a notebook that we'll be sending out in the next week or two that includes summaries of all the leases which have now been signed, schematics for the projects, as best we can put together at this point, a briefing booklet on the entire project that we'll send out to you. But it's slowly but surely moving along, and bond anticipation notes have been sold, which allows a lot of the work to get underway in anticipation of new market tax credits at the federal level. And so the quicker TIF revenue can be generated, the better off every aspect of the project will be. But we anticipate being underway, not we, but John's, the SPE2 that John is on, and the whole downtown redevelopment group and the master developer, in the next week or two with the parking garage and relocation of 14th Street. So that's unfolding. Now, we did just do a closing with, to take it a step further, with Sigma Chi last week.
We did.
For that piece of property along Center Street, so they can go on and get started on their house. So slowly but surely, things are beginning to take shape there, and we'll have, we're still waiting on a document or two from the architect, but we'll have that notebook together shortly to get you a printed book on the whole project.
That property was owned by Student Life Foundation, right?
That's correct.
Quick question. I received an email from Parking and Transportation Services yesterday, and the parking lot you're talking about would be the Kentucky Street gravel lot, which is right next to the Kentucky paved lot, correct?
Correct.
That's a student tailgating area, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Correct.
Plans for compensation at all?
No, no. tailgating is an interesting...
He's thinking.
Well, there is a tailgating committee, and I don't usually attend all those meetings, so I can't answer that. Who on the tailgating committee?
I sent an email to Lindsay Thomas earlier this morning and heard back from her at lunch, and she informed me that last tailgating, last game, home game, there was not more than a few cars over there. I understand that, but I was actually in that lot with student government cooking out for the students for the first home game, and that lot and the paved lot were packed and was spilling in across the street, so...
Yeah, we need to address that. I would look forward to recommendations from the tailgating committee and SGA and athletic department on how that might be done, because we need to create additional space somewhere close by.
Excellent.
Homecoming's next week.
Well, I think most people will be on South Lawn for homecoming, including us. So.
But I think the irony is they're actually planning to put the fencing up and start closing 14th Street and start preparing site for work for the project next week before homecoming. The last word I got.
Monday's the last I heard.
Yeah. The thing I did was tell them, look, don't you dare help us close this and you not start. So our position is that they understood that they had to mobilize and actually be ready to work in the area, not just put up the fences and then let it sit. So our plan was put the fences up, start work.
Thank you, John.
Anything else?
Very much, sir.
Thank you.
Ann, development update.
We'll find the slides for the development report. I think. President Ransdell, you'd say the most important development announcement is the hiring of our new vice president, Catherine Costello, who I think many of you had a chance to meet at the luncheon.
Some of you did. Those from out of town may not have been able to, but Catherine Costello begins her duties January 1, but she was here last week, and she will be here next week for a few days trying to finish up some house hunting and with to be here for several of our homecoming activities on Thursday evening through Friday. But you remember her credentials, I expect. Catherine most recently has been a consultant with Alexander Hostel Neil Martin, a consulting firm in Atlanta. Her contract with a consultant client at the University of Buffalo turned into an actual two-year appointment as vice president. But prior to that was vice president with me at Southern Methodist University in the 80s, which is where we first became acquainted. Went on to be vice president at University of Maryland, Rice University, and the University of Georgia. Splendid career, great experience and success, and really looking forward to her leading our alumni development programs. But in that interim, I'd be remiss if I didn't compliment and thank Ann for her leadership in the interim over these last few months. It's the development staff has benefited from that, and the university has as well. And I almost think Ann's starting to turn into a bit of a fundraiser here with on the private side. She's been doing it on the public side for years, but she has worn both hats well.
Thank you. I've been focusing most of my career on our most significant donor, which is the General Assembly, along with Robin Taylor. But it's a great staff, and I'm pleased to go ahead if we can get technological answers.
You might mention that you sort of stole Tom Heil from her.
Yeah, back in 1998, when we were clearly in need for a vice president for institutional advancement, I just come out of that world, and so I knew that network pretty well. There's one name that I didn't know about that kind of kept coming up when I'd contact colleagues, and a fellow named Tom Hiles, and he was the director of campaigns at Rice University. Catherine was the vice president at Rice, so I called Catherine and tell me about a guy named Tom Hiles, and that conversation contained a lot of language that I probably shouldn't repeat here, but the essence of it was you stay the heck away from my guy. And she sent us Tom Hiles, and we've been able to remain friends.
Now we got her.
Yeah, now we got her.
Well, I'm sure going into the end of the capital campaign, the New Century of Spirit 2012, she'll make us reach our goal and probably exceed it. But as of the end of September, we are at 84% of our target of $200 million, bringing in cash and pledges of $167.9 million. When the campaign was established, it was established with goals, especially as it relates to programs, people, and places. In terms of programs, we're at approximately 83% of our goal, with $100 million as the target. In this slide, we're featuring the Fleischacker Green gift for journalism. In terms of people, we're at about 47.4 million, or 63% of our target. In terms of people, we're talking about endowed professorships and chairs and scholarships. To date, we have seven, not just this campaign, but we added to it, 772 endowed scholarships. Several of you attended the scholarship celebration dinner a few weeks ago. Almost 500 people were in attendance. It was an incredible event, my first time attending, and I've told several audiences I went away feeling a little bit sad because I didn't have a student and I didn't have an endowed scholarship. Quickly, a development officer cornered me and said, we can make that happen. So, over 1,200 students this year, this fall, are receiving one or more scholarships due to private giving, which is very impactful. Over 1,200 students. Into your agenda book, I gave you a listing of current chairs, professorships, and who the recipients are in their programs. I thought it would be helpful for you to have an update on our endowed professorships. We just finished fiscal year 10. It's hard to believe there was much good news out of fiscal year 10, but the state did put in $2.4 million for WKU to match for what we commonly call Bucks for Brains, the endowment program. $2.4 million was fully matched. That $2.4 million allowed us to either create or expand 72 different endowments. So there is a lot going on that's good in terms of people and programs. The last category is places. We have blown the socks off of that goal, being that we only set it at $25 million and we're past $37 million. Obviously, significant gifts related to the stadium, the Alumni Center, and the chapel have contributed to our success in this category. Endowments as of the end of September, $103.7 million.
Touch on that a minute. You would like, in the ideal world, to raise brick-and-mortar money for academic buildings. But that is not a particularly realistic thing, and it's not something that most benefactors who are going to give personal resources are typically going to do it to a endowed faculty position, a scholarship, or a project that's near and dear to their heart. And in many cases, that's not necessarily an academic building, which most donors expect the state to build. But the state's not going to build other things on a university campus that are important to a campus. And that's where benefactors come in, because we couldn't have a lot of the things on our campus that we have were it not for private support. So we try to reserve our state funding capital project priority list for academic buildings, but we've not gone to the state for a residence hall, for an auxiliary building, for a campus restaurant, for all the other student life things that we have across campus. That's kind of how we philosophically approach the campus rebuilding, is focus on academic buildings for state-funded priorities, and let's try to do everything else with either private support, auxiliary support, or other funding strategies. That's so far that's worked pretty well for us. The pipeline is a little lean right now on state-funded capital projects, but we'll be back in there pitching as soon as the state's able to have something to pitch for.
This slide gives you an overview of where our endowment funds are held, and as of the end of September, $103.7 million in endowment funds. Lastly, annual private giving. For this fiscal year alone, we're at a little more than $4.7 million, with a significant component from corporations. Let me note that we have a little over 1,100 members of the President's Circle. That's the group that gives annually $1,000 or more. a very significant source to the cash needs. While the pledges and the estate gifts are good news for WKU, it's the cash needs that are funding many of the enhancement funds programs that are important to academics. I have a few gift items to share with you. William Horrell Estate, a little over $90,000 for scholarships in history and biology. A scholarship fund in the memory of John Danny Annis was established at $100,000. PNC Wealth Management, $116,000 for Potter Harmon scholarships in the College Heights Foundation. AT&T, through the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, gave a gift of $125,000 in support of the Gatton Academy for Math and Science. This is the Commonwealth Institute for Parent Leadership. Very good program. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a $227,000 gift to biology for basic research to enable agricultural development. We continue to raise funds for the SkyTeach. I hope maybe at a future meeting we can focus on that, and Dr. Emsley can bring a few individuals in. But as you probably know, on the SkyTeach, WKU was one of 12 schools selected, and we were given the challenge of matching $1 million in funds. Now, with Bucks for Brains, you can match it with pledges. With the SkyTeach program, it has to be actual gifts. At this point, if our pledges are fulfilled, we will be within $23,000 of raising the $1 million target, which is an incredible effort on part of the development officers, especially Amanda Litch and Krista Steenburgen, who have spearheaded that effort. So I hope at a future board meeting we can focus on SkyTeach and the donations and what the program will do. Dr. Walter Scott, $1,750,000 bequest for the Scott Professorship in Physiology. We have two significant announcements coming up, and I'm not allowed to tell you. They tell me I had to zip my lips, but you've probably gotten an announcement. We have a significant gift announcement coming up, rated homecoming, related to the Alumni Center, and another wonderful gift announcement that will occur in the middle of November. Any questions? That's my report.
Okay, Ann, thank you so much. Yes.
I would like to give Ann a compliment. She's really taken to this new development position. She called me a few days ago, and I was expecting to hear about the audit, and first thing she said was, do you mind if I set up a meeting with you, me, and someone from the development office when you come down? And I said, well, okay. And I said, well, what about the audit? And she said, oh, no problem. Attendably, it's clean.
She's wanting money out of you.
I thought, you really like this new position.
Good girl. Thank you so much, Ann. Before we go to the finance, Colton, did you have something you were going to pass out there?
Yes, just real briefly. I came onto this board. I was welcome and given a pen, so I figured I would give a pen back. Not near as prestigious, but the WKU Student Government Association, we're working on our PR a little bit more this year. We've got some cups and some pens, and these pens are very nice, so I figured I would give each of the board members, and if we've got left over, anybody else who wants some. So, Mr. Zoki, I left one after your chair.
I took it.
I think I gave you one.
Larry, did you give those out when
Thank
you were president?
You.
I didn't give anything out. You didn't have any money, David.
Just a thank you. And, from the Student Government Association for all that you all do for the university.
Thank you.
You're a good man.
I've been using mine already. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, let's move along here. David, we're at the Finance and Budget Committee.
Okay, I'll direct your attention to the action items, 3.1.